You just simply cannot interrupt greatness, and that is greatness from the great, incomparable, legendary queen of the Hammond organ, Shirley Scott, opening up on Eddie Lockjaw Davis's Skillet. Absolutely one of my favorite pieces. Shirley Scott, who was married to saxophone player Stanley Turrentine, also played the trumpet and the piano with equal authority. This number is from Volume 2 of Davis's cookbook series on the Prestige label, released in 1958, with, as I said, Eddie Lockjaw Davis on tenor sax, Jerome Richardson on flute, George Duvivier on bass, and Arthur Edgehill on drums. Shirley Scott died on March the 10th, 2002, and it was just 4 days before her 68th birthday. But she left a statement about her talent before she went. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Wednesday, March the 4th, and two topics for your consideration today. Eric Holder, the U.S. Attorney General, who will be departing shortly, urges reform of Ferguson, Missouri's police department, but there's no word on whether there will be justice for Michael Brown. That comes in the second half of our program today, but first I want to talk about the bully in the pulpit. Why no one stopped Benjamin Netanyahu's hostile takeover in Congress yesterday. Prime Minister Netanyahu, enabled and emboldened by House Majority Leader John Boehner, the lobby group posing as a public affairs committee, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, and a heavily Republican assortment of Obama haters, relished Netanyahu's 43 minutes of fame yesterday before a joint session of Congress. The intent was clear in Netanyahu's speech, and of course by the intent of the facilitators of that speech. It was, of course, to scuttle the U.S.-led negotiations with Iran on its nuclear program. But it was much more than that. Much more than that. And so it behooves us to ask the question today why no one, including those who said they were opposed to Netanyahu's exceedingly undiplomatic and intrusive appearance, stopped Netanyahu and the hostile takeover of Congress. You know, I was reminded yesterday, oddly enough, of David Dinkins, the former mayor of the city of New York, the first African-American mayor of the city of New York. And the visual was just incredible to me, because when I was the editor of the newspaper, I wrote about it. It was an extraordinary image to have. And the image was this. Here is a news reporter at the gates of Gracie Mansion. That's the official residence of the mayor of the city of New York. It is, I remembered it being a Sunday or so. I am not sure about that, but the visual was behind the gate of Gracie Mansion, there is this kind of beaten up station wagon. It just did not go with Gracie Mansion. And there are people unloading crates of files. It wasn't that the mayor was moving in. It was that the Hasidic community, lawyers for the Hasidic community of Crown Heights, and members of the Hasidic community of Crown Heights actually had, in a way, invaded Gracie Mansion for the purpose of deposing the mayor relative to the 1991 outbreak of violence in Crown Heights after two young children were run over by a car that was in the convoy of the Grand Rebbe of Crown Heights, one of them killed and the other seriously wounded. And it touched off 3 days of unrest in Crown Heights, in which a young Hasidic student, Talmudic student, Yankel Rosenbaum, was stabbed to death. Not a good time at all in Crown Heights. But the visual was, here is the mayor of the city of New York, and they are in his house, where he lives with his wife, the official residence. And they're in there, ordered by a judge who said, yes, you could go into Gracie Mansion and you depose the mayor in Gracie Mansion. And not only that, we open this up to the press because the reporters need to see this. And so the reporters witnessed a mayor in his own house being deposed with respect to what part did he play in the 3 days of violence in Crown Heights? So the whole world saw this. And it is not a wrong thing. I mean, part of the civil suit by Yankel Rosenbaum's family and by the Hasidic community had to do with the contention, they said, that Dinkins was so inept, he refused to respond appropriately and in a timely fashion, and that contributed to the outbreak of violence in Crown Heights. Well, it's a legitimate claim. It should have happened. A deposition was perfectly in order. But in his house, it was meant to say, there is nothing that is sacred when it comes to you. We can do whatever we want. And it was the same feeling I got yesterday with Benjamin Netanyahu imposing himself literally in the innards of the supposedly the nerve center of what we proudly call here our democracy, where the business of government is transacted by the people for the people. And here we have a man who, I mean, it's not like he is an exemplar of leadership. In fact, the very day that he left to make the speech, the very day that he made this speech, I should say, his government cut off electricity again to Nablus and Jenna and basically caused a blackout again for Palestinians. Just one way of reminding them of who's boss. This is a person who, according to a columnist writing an opinion in Haaretz just yesterday, called him the worst prime minister in Israel's history. Here's a person who literally, as he was leaving his own country, the attorney general of Israel was considering launching a major criminal investigation and prosecution of him for misuse of funds, him and his wife. Here's a person who the FBI had said, and I read you that story, the FBI had said that this man was actually a person who had engaged in running nuclear material from the United States to Israel. And the FBI said this. The FBI confirmed this. This is not a person who is clean as the driven snow. This is a person who is known for his recklessness and known for his absolute conviction that he and he alone knows what is best for not just Israel, but for the planet. He knows everything. He can't be managed. And so they open up the Congress to him. Come on in. Well, now he has reason to boast that he is of the caliber of Winston Churchill, because Winston Churchill had addressed an open session, a joint session of Congress, three times. And in that sense, yes, there is a commonality, because Winston Churchill himself was a Zionist. So we have this invasion is really what it was, facilitated by a group which itself, this is the American Israel Public Affairs Committee, which is a lobbying group. Everybody knows that. They say that themselves because they had Lobby Day just concluded, in which they predicted at least two-thirds of Congress, members of Congress, the House and the Senate, will come by to pay their respects. So we have a scenario here of, I mean, it's very untidy. It reeks of corruption and political, you know, that the seamy underside of politics. It's not, pardon the pun, it ain't kosher. So why did no one, despite the fact that, you know, they had their ritualistic post speech analysis, and the Democrats were there saying that, you know, how upset they were and they did not approve and all of that stuff, but nobody said, get out of here. You can't come here. We won't allow it. Not on a personal level. Let's talk about the first thing first. This is not a personal thing. This is about the office of the President of the United States, whether you like Barack Obama or you don't. And you know I've been extremely critical of Barack Obama, but the man is President of the United States. He was voted into office not once but twice. He was given a mandate to be at the helm of this country. And for that alone, people ought to respect the office, whether you agree with the president or you don't, whether you like him or you don't. To invite this horrible man with his known horrible ways, with all of his horrible baggage that you conveniently set aside. You know, the United States is supposed to be so mindful of human rights abuses. Well, what did we have in Congress yesterday? One of the biggest human rights abuses there is. The man who personally oversees what is called the largest open-air prison in the world, and that is Gaza. We don't need to recount here the atrocities that have occurred and continue to occur under his leadership. But there he is, and dominates a joint session of Congress, all of it choreographed by John Boehner, a complete toady to the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee. And no one is able to say, no, we ain't going to have it. It's just not going to be done. We will not allow the office of the President of the United States to be disrespected this way. The man didn't even clear it with the president. He didn't clear it with the White House, which is typical and normal and expected when a head of state visits another country. I don't even have to talk to you, but I could come in your house and tear you up. Crown Heights Revisited. Now, why? Why was this allowed? Because even the people who stand there beating their chests about, oh, we disapprove of this. This is just awful. They wouldn't say what we saw. They wouldn't say what this was. They don't have the guts, literally, to stand up for what is right. And let's be very clear about this. It's a racist maneuver. That's on one level. But a very important level here. Because part of the job of the Democratic Party with Barack Obama being the titular head of the party, you would imagine that the Democratic Party ain't going to have anything to do with this and will never allow the head of state, their Democratic leader, to be insulted this way. But they just made it clear, well, we are on the record, we have registered our displeasure. But they're not going to form a flank of protection for their leader, who we cannot escape is the first black president of the United States, whose administration has just about outdone all previous administrations with respect to billions of free money given to Israel. But of course, can't do enough. And more than $120 billion has gone to this welfare state at the same time that Americans don't have jobs, don't have housing, have rotten schools, Israel has a very good economy. Israel has appropriate housing because they're expanding the territories. They're expanding into the settlement areas. They're settling and driving more and more Palestinians out to provide more housing, you see? But all of this is not seen at all as being important to put on the record that, A, you are not going, we are not going to allow you to disgrace and dishonor the President of the United States. We stand with the President, and especially because we have an extra duty. This is the first black man, the first black person elected in office, but it's not just about that, but it is also that. It is also that you're wrong. You're wrong. You're dead wrong. Even if John Boehner had the temerity to unilaterally invite a head of state to address a joint session of Congress without asking anybody's permission, that doesn't mean you allow it to stand. You make sure that that does not happen. That's a piece of political work. But you see, they're all playing the same game. The opponents, as they would like to be seen, are deep in the pockets of AIPAC. They're all beholden to AIPAC. AIPAC owns them, runs them. AIPAC has absolute control over U.S. foreign policy. And what we saw yesterday was that whether by omission or by commission, these horrific people facilitated something that they will live to regret, and that is they allowed another head of state, an outsider. And again, it's not like he's a credentialed person. He doesn't know what he's doing in Israel. He doesn't know what the heck he's doing. He's creating more chaos. He is really not the best representative of his country. But they're so deep into AIPAC's pockets. There's so much money being thrown around to peddle influence, that they can't and they couldn't say, all right, we are taking a definitive line here. We just are not in this. We are done. This is not good for our country. We are not going to facilitate this. Now, you know, you wonder, I mean, they must think everybody is an idiot. They must think that the whole country, that, you know, it's reached a stage where they don't even pretend to hide these things. It's in your face. Here's a head of state saying, I could come in your country and I could tear up whatever it is you're planning. I could interfere in your internal affairs. I can scuttle whatever it is you're doing. I can do that. And I have people inside your country who will help me. It's the same thing as a coup. It's on a diplomatic level. That's what it is. I have the power and authority as a person not at all elected here and a person with all this baggage that I have. I still have more clout than the man you elected, and I could come in your house and rearrange your affairs to suit my liking. Great. Fantastic. And nobody was in a position to definitively say it's not going to happen. And is it accidental or just incidental that this is happening with the first African American president elected in the United States, where there is such a disdain, a racial animus, that even members of his own party leave him out there to twist in the wind and leave the country open to this interloper. They don't have the guts. They don't have the guts. Benjamin Netanyahu actually is a wanted man. The FBI has been wanting to talk to him, but he escapes that. And you look at all these exceptions, always for Israel, all these exceptions. It gives the appearance, because it is the reality, that they don't have to follow any rules. No rules apply to them. They make the rules if there are to be rules. And everybody, in one way or the other, has to walk in lockstep with that. So this feigned opposition yesterday, this feigned opposition to the Netanyahu's speech, does not impress me. I'm real clear about it. David Dinkins was a test case. Yeah, we're coming in, Gracie Mansion. We're coming in there to depose you in your house where you and your wife live. That's as intimate as you could get. As if there is no other place where a deposition can be conducted. Aided and abetted by a sympathetic judge that said, for symbolic reasons, we are going to humiliate you. Same here yesterday. For symbolic reasons, Benjamin Netanyahu was aided and abetted in humiliating not the president of the United States alone, but the whole country with a hostile takeover of the apparatus of government, and the doing everything possible to tell people, oh, well, this is just about a speech. No, it's not about a speech. He doesn't have the capacity to make a logical speech. But he doesn't have the authority either. And one questions, why all these exceptions all the time? AIPAC won yesterday. Yesterday demonstrated the degree to which there is a parallel power structure in this country that has its way whether you want it or not. Money, influence, corruption prevail because they want what they want. They will get what they want. Money. And no one is brave enough, courageous enough, or ethical enough to stand up and say, this ends now. We are not going to sanction the invasion and the message to the world. All voters in the United States should be very aware as of yesterday that, in fact, your votes don't count. Your process of democracy doesn't count because there are people who are well-positioned to have their way. They rule this government. They have power and influence, and they don't have necessarily to show up even at the voting booth. That's for you and me, the poor minions, going. Go and pull that lever and say you've participated in democracy. When we have a shadow system, by any definition, what happened yesterday in Congress was an act almost of I wouldn't say treason, but sedition. You bring a person in specifically to disrupt the democratic process. You bring a person specifically to destroy your process. And you give it all the legitimacy. And all of the media people suddenly
are looking at this one-dimensionally. This is about, well, you know, should he have come? Did he break protocol? And that is not the issue, and they know that. No one has put this story into context, because context would be very embarrassing. You will have to now call Mr. Netanyahu's credentials into question. You will now have to raise the disturbing issues that surround him. You will now have to point out the irony that here's a guy who is saying, well, we can't allow Iran to have nuclear power, but no one is raising questions about Israel's nuclear power under Netanyahu. What is the state of Israel's nuclear power with an excess, supposedly, of more than 200 nuclear warheads? And the role that this particular man played, according to the FBI, in basically stealing nuclear triggers and other equipment out of the United States through a false front of a Philadelphia-based company to shuttle them to Israel. And all those years, nothing has happened to him. He's never been questioned. He's never been brought to justice. No charges ever filed. And Israel, according to Barack Obama himself, receiving billions of dollars every year up front. The only state, the only welfare state that this country supports that gets its money not in dribs and drabs, but in one fell swoop up front. More than $120 billion in bilateral assistance. And yesterday, a reminder of who's boss. The recipient of that largesse reminded the world yesterday, you don't have to pay attention to Barack Obama. I'm in charge here. So the second president of the United States was afforded the opportunity to address the minions. No questions asked, really. And if those that were asked were basically silly questions about protocol. And not about who this man is and what it is he represents. Everything that is anathema, supposedly, to the high ideals of America. But there he is in the bowels of your legislative process, like a bacterium, infecting it or attempting to infect it so as to cause dis-ease. So, don't tell me that this was just a diplomatic blunder. This was a hostile takeover. That's what that was. Aided and abetted by people in the United States, people like John Boehner, whose disdain, the racial animus has not been fully expiated. And to facilitate the expression of that, they're willing even to destroy the country. If I can't have the parade, ain't gonna be a parade. That's the thinking. I'll take this break and come back and talk about Mr. Holder right after this.
Thank you.
Listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM, I'm Utrice Lead. The Justice Department today releases a report on its six-month investigation of the Ferguson Police Department that statistically confirms what locals have known for years, that African Americans in the small Missouri town were and are the targets of racist cops and a racist system that protects them for wrongdoing. The probe began, as you know, in the explosive aftermath of the shooting of 18-year-old Michael Brown on August the 9th last year by Darren Wilson, a police officer who quit the 53-member force after a local grand jury found no reason to indict him. U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder, I should mention his first name, who soon departs the Obama administration, has not yet announced whether Wilson will face federal civil rights charges. He has said only that the legal standards are very high to make a federal case. So is this a matter of high standards or a matter of low performance? Well, it's a classic ploy. Eric Holder is going to be leaving soon as his replacement is confirmed. And it's a gift. You know, you give with one hand and you take with the other. Right after Michael Brown was killed, and right after the local district attorney, Bob McCullough, said that there was no reason to indict. The grand jury found no reason to indict. And you remember we did this. We looked at this case in infinite detail through the expert help of Alton Maddox, and we both came to the conclusion that this was just not going to yield any results, certainly not the results that people were looking for. And so came the demand by the attorneys for the family and by the representatives, I'm specifically referring now to Al Sharpton, that there ought to be a federal investigation. And it's a clear indication whenever anybody calls for federal investigation, it is usually because they are aware that there is little, if any, hope at the local level. And we know that this particular office of Attorney General Eric Holder hasn't had very much of a record of championing or being successful at getting cases like this resolved via federal indictments. Because, you see, the standards are so high. The standards to prove wrongdoing, because everybody's arguing about how difficult it is to prove intention by the police officer, that the intent in killing Michael Brown was racially motivated. There was racial animus there. So on a technical level, they build that argument that, you know, don't get your hopes up too high because the intent is hard to prove that the police officer from the beginning had some kind of a racial motivation for shooting or killing in one way or the other a person. All right. the tactic is you give them something. You give the people something. And so the something that the people got today is a report that says what they've known all along. The local department in Ferguson, Missouri, at the time of Michael Brown's death, was consisting of 53 police officers, only three of them African American. And if you followed this program, you know that we've discussed Ferguson, Missouri, as a race town. That's its history. It was described by Richard Rothstein, who did a very comprehensive study of the history of Ferguson, to be a sundown town. You can come in if you have reason to be there, meaning you're working there, if you're African-American, but by sundown, the expectation is you have no reason to be in Ferguson. You've got to be invisible. You've got to get out. It's called a sundown town. Places like that that operate with that kind of standing practice. So the U.S. Attorney General confirms what people have known, and they've done a study, and it took 6 months, and they interviewed a whole lot of people, and they came up with these statistics, which, by the way, have always been available. These statistics, they wanted to believe that they just unearthed them, and so they're new. They're not new. And they're not unique, either, to Ferguson, Missouri. This is all over the country. This particular profile is typical of what happens all over the country. So when you get this report today, it would appear that the U.S. Attorney General is being very proactive, and he has delivered something. And what he has delivered is statistical confirmation that what people have been claiming all along in Ferguson, Missouri, isn't indeed true. And that suffices as justice. So the report now recommends reform. And how do you reform Ferguson? You reform Ferguson's police department by, well, you threaten to sue it as the Justice Department to comply with affirmative action and fair practices, or you move to disband the police department, which means the same renegades in that department will seek employment elsewhere, as Darren Wilson himself has. You just shuffle the deck, the chairs on the deck of the Titanic. There is nobody going to jail for anything. There's nobody who's going to be really affected adversely who participated in perpetrating and maintaining this system of apartheid in Ferguson. This is really an administrative move. Think of it like a memo that goes out. We've discovered some practices that are very troubling. We're not going to have it anymore. So with this memo, we expect that things will improve. You will do whatever has to be done so that it doesn't happen again. And he's off, Eric Holder, to an afterlife. This is the same man. I was the only reporter in the room, allowed in, as a matter of fact, when Amadou Diallo in New York City was killed, and by 41 shots fired at him, 19 of them piercing his body. He was literally at his house doing nothing criminal at all. And four police officers with guns drawn came toward him because they thought, it turned out in the trial, they thought he fit the profile of someone in the neighborhood said to be committing a number of rapes. And Amadou Diallo from Guinea was shot and killed. Well, Eric Holder was then the head of the Civil Rights Division of the Department of Justice. He was the top guy. And a group of African elders and chiefs and leaders asked me to accompany them to this meeting, this private meeting. And I tell you, I was not a welcome guest, because once we got up there, first I was barred downstairs. They would not allow me up. But once I did get upstairs, because the chief said, if she's not in this room, we are not having a meeting. So they relented and brought me upstairs, and I saw the usual suspects. There's Al Sharpton and Charlie Rangel and the lot. And supposedly they were trying to get the Justice Department to do something. And guess what? Nothing. Not even in a case where police officers, four of them, fired 41 shots, killed this man for no reason whatsoever. In fact, the exact opposite happened. The case was moved out of the venue because, of course, the people of the Bronx could not be trusted to render justice. So they were able to move the case to Albany, New York. They shopped and got a sympathetic judge. And lo and behold, no indictments, no convictions, I should say. They all walked, including the officer who said, well, he displayed his sympathy because he held and looked into the eyes of Amadou Diallo, who he just shot as he lay dying. It worked well for the jury. So here we have a systemic problem. And the department that is pointing out the systemic problem itself has a systemic problem. It is not inclined to do vigorous prosecutions of these crimes. It is not inclined to give the assurance to the citizens of the United States of America, especially those with a history of being targeted unfairly, a history of being the victims of unwarranted encroachments in the civil rights and violations of their civil rights, including death. The department does not have a very good history of defending the rights of its African-American citizens of the United States. Because, you see, the standards are so high. My contention is that the performance level is so low. And there is an unwillingness, and it is a historic one. This is not new. In fact, we told you, if you listen to this program, we told you exactly what was going to happen, and so it has. Everything we said was going to happen has happened. And that is not because we have ESP, Alton Maddox and myself. It is because history, there are facts. These are tangible facts and statistics that allow you to make a reasonable prediction as to where things will go. The question now becomes, what do people do? What do people do? I mean, the Justice Department can't deliver justice. What do people do? You're not getting justice at the local level, because that is severely compromised, and we know why and how, and we said it. Just like in the Eric Garner case, we know how and why, and we said it. And it is exactly the way it is, exactly the way we said it. I was able to make use of my many years covering these cases, and you see the same rituals, the same modus operandi occurring. So therefore you know that the outcome is inevitable. There will be no justice, not in these cases of police officers taking the lives of African American and Latino men, mostly. This is the dynamic. But for political reasons, you'll get a report if you're lucky, if they feel particularly generous. You'll get a report. And the report says, guess what? We have found out, and here's statistical proof, that what people have been saying all along is actually true. And now the Justice Department gets to take credit for having rectified a problem. But of course, we know it hasn't. The question remains, what do we do? You can't get justice, or you're not getting justice at the local level, and you're not getting justice at the federal level. What do you do? Now, for Mr. Holder, he goes on, life goes on, he gets to live a very productive afterlife politically, and he gets to point to the fact that he has done an investigation, and that's his contribution to justice in Ferguson, Missouri. The worst thing that could happen now is that they may just disband this particular police force, and it's, you know, cosmetic. It's cosmetic change. If a cop is dislocated from Ferguson, he goes next door to the next town and gets hired, taking with him the same mentality, the same attitudes, the same record of rights abuse. But what do we do? That's, I keep asking the question, what do you do? What is the solution here? And why are we to believe that this is a major, major solution, as the media will be covering this, as a major solution here, the Justice Department hard at work protecting the constitutional rights of African Americans, especially those in Ferguson, Missouri. So today, these two subjects, which really are, would seem to be unrelated, but it's actually the same story. People playing games with your mind. At one level, we have the President of the United States and the people of the United States, the will of the people supplanted by a well-financed effort of covert action to disrupt the democratic process that allegedly obtains in this country. I can't wait, by the way, for an invitation for Barack Obama to address the Knesset about human rights abuses in Israel, about the hardship, the atrocities that occurred in Gaza. I can't wait for that kind of quid pro quo, to have the President of the United States go to Israel and address the Knesset on matters of major importance that threaten to scuttle international action in the world community of nations around questions of human rights. Hopefully John Boehner could see what he could do, and maybe as a gesture of goodwill, Benjamin Netanyahu will arrange for his colleague to come to address the Knesset. See if that would be tolerated. And with respect to Mr. Holder, we've been snowed again by this administration and by this particular department into believing that black people really do have lives that matter in this country. And in both instances, we have a compliant and supportive media telling the story just as they want it told. Paul Craig Roberts has coined the term, at least I think so, calling the media the prostitutes, because they selectively decide when not to engage in the science and art of journalism, to ask questions, to demand answers, to point out the problems, and to remind the public that they are watchdogs, not just dogs. I want to thank you for joining me today. We are getting back to our fully reconstituted selves at PRN. The studios are being built up, and move is going to be imminent to permanent headquarters. So bear with us for just a little bit longer. We have missed our, and I certainly have, our Friday, Free Your Mind Friday sessions. We are kind of limited in the ability to take calls and to interact with each other right now as the innards are being reconfigured. That would be done very shortly, completed very shortly. But I hope these programs, nonetheless, are asking you to really take care of the most precious piece of real estate you'll ever own in your life, which is your mind. Everybody's after it. But please secure it. A pleasure always, and a great privilege to be in your company. And we'll see each other tomorrow. We'll be talking about Venezuela, the coup in progress, aided and abetted by the United States. See you tomorrow. Mm-hmm.